War, bombings, terror. Is history repeating itself? We see it happening all around the world. And today's episode is about resilience in the face of war. The activists that are born out of war and the stories we must share to try our best to prevent it from happening again and again. For today's episode, I was humbled and honored to have a chance to speak with Dr. Amani Ballour, a distinguished Syrian pediatrician, activist, and the author of The Cave, a secret underground hospital and one woman's story of survival in Syria. This is the story of a young woman who wanted a chance at education in a society that didn't value a woman's contributions. And time again, she proved everyone wrong by pursuing a career in medicine. And at the very same time, a war was breaking loose in Syria under the Assad regime. We speak about Dr. Ballour's experiences from running an underground hospital during the Syrian conflict to facing chemical attacks and her eventual displacement. Her experiences highlight the critical issues faced by civilians in war zones, particularly women and children. These crises are not only unthinkable, but they are happening right now in Ukraine. They're happening in Gaza. And 12 years after the fighting began, they are still happening in Syria. Her story, growing up under Assad's regime to becoming a symbol of hope and determination, is extraordinary. And the way that she tells her story humanizes the Syrian crisis and sheds light on the pivotal role of women in conflict zones around the world. My name is Ethel Bauman, and this is the Global Health Pursuit. Dr. Amani, I'm beyond honored to have you be a guest on my podcast. I know that you've done probably thousands of interviews throughout your time in Syria. And to tell you the truth, I've actually been just like this past hour, I've been really nervous because your story is something that I want to be able to share in a very intentional way. And you come from a world that is like, I can't imagine. And for me to ask you about your story is really, it's put me in a very like humbled position. So welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the Global Health Pursuit podcast. Dr. Amani, I'm very, very humbled to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thank you for your kind words.
Of course. So I really wanted to start out by asking you to paint a picture of what life was like for you growing up. You know, what was it like growing up in Syria? And something that you had mentioned in your new book, The Cave, that we're going to be talking about throughout this interview is, you know, you talk about how growing up, there was always this sentiment where young women were always married off very young, and the standards for women and men were very different. They might still be. And it's something that I resonate with because, as somebody with a family from India, it's just something that I'm so curious about. I shared with you that my grandmother was 14 when she got married. And that's something that when I look at her photos from when she was married, it's just so foreign to me. And it makes me think about, you know, if I was born in that era, what would life be like for me? So can you talk a little bit about growing up?
In Syria, we have different communities, different cities. So, you know, every place has their own customs, tradition. So I come from countryside of Damascus, and we are a conservative community. We have our customs, and, you know, we our people there differentiate between boys and girls, men and women. And that starts when we were around 10 or 10 years old. You start to hear that you are a girl, you can't do this, this not allowed for girls. I think it's very early to hear that. For example, some place to go outside, play in the street. Here you start to hear this, that no, you are a girl, you can't go, you can't do this, you can't, for example, play football, you can't ride a bicycle,
a bike.
You are a girl. And if I remember, like, a girl in my town was riding a bicycle and everyone were, gossip about her and talk about her. No, that's very shame to ride a bicycle for a girl. She was like 12 or 13. So yeah, and that was in 1990. But now it's a little different. In my community, we still, we still have this idea against women. So as a child, yeah, I hear these ideas, I hear these thoughts, and I always found it not justified. I mean, I always asked why. I mean, why? What's the difference? Why my brother can do this and I can't? Why I can't, as a kid, have all these questions? And the only answer I heard is, it's shame. You can't do this. So yeah, I faced this like other girls in my community. And my sisters got married very early. My sister was 13 when she got married. And that was, when I was a kid, when she got married, I didn't find it like strange because everyone in my community was at the same age, maybe, or around this, they get married. But when I became younger, I found like when I was 13, I found myself like very, I mean, when someone talk about marriage next to me, I feel, no, I'm not ready. I mean, I don't want to get married.
Yeah.
I was good at school and I wanted to continue studying to become like something important in my community and start, dreaming. And I wanted to be an engineer. Also, again, I hear this from my father this time saying, no, you can't be an engineer. You are a girl. It's not for girls, So, but, doctors in my community have a good position. Everyone respect doctors, like I think other places also. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, my father say you can be a doctor, but not an engineer, And this is a change with my sister, because for my sisters, I remember my second sister, she wanted to study, but my father said, no, it's not good to study and you have to get married. And he made a little pressure on her. And that, changed after this because I was the youngest and I'm the youngest. So my father now started to change his mind. He made my three sisters get married. So I still alone at home. So he said, it's okay, let her study. And I was very good at school. I got the marks to enter the faculty of medicine, which is not easy in Syria to study medicine, to be a doctor. So my father was happy. And, I told everyone respect doctors. So he was happy to see me. Now I will be a doctor. And since I started studying, I was at the first year, he started say everywhere that my daughter is a doctor. So he was proud of me. I didn't want to be a doctor at the beginning, but to have these marks and to start studying, then like month after month, year after year, I start to love this. And I found out that this is a good way to help people to be a doctor. I mean, you can do a lot to help everyone. You can have a good position, so make others listen to you. And this is, a problem for me, especially as a girl. No one listened to me, and especially the youngest kid in the family. No one, they don't give me this attention. So I wanted people to listen to me. So, yeah, I found this good. And I, at the fourth year of the medical school, I wanted to be a pediatrician. I like kids. I wanted to help them, play with them, or this is what I thought before, the war, and to see, I didn't imagine that I will see wounded kids are bleeding, kids with very serious cases. I didn't think about this. I just thought that I will meet the kids and play with them, try to help them. But when I was at the fifth year, the Syrian revolution started, people started to protest in the streets. And, it's a very long story, I'm now 13 years. after this revolution. But immediately after the protests, the Syrian regime started to shoot people, to kill them, arrest everyone, participate, and torture them to death.
Yeah.
And this happened really early, and people insist, you know, demanding only some human rights, some dignity, right, which we don't have in Syria. After this, I decided to not continue studying, to stay in my city in the Syrian regime with its allies, Russia and Iran. Besieged us for nearly 6 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just said a whole lot in that last 5 minutes. I was like, oh my goodness, I think going from being a child who loved, you know, going to school, having good marks and being the youngest in the family and having your dad say, okay, you can study, that's fine. I know there was a lot of influence coming from your mom too, because I remembered in the book, you mentioned how your mom would say, you know, if you have education, you can do anything, right? And so even before we talk about like the conflict that had started, I want to get your thoughts on even just going to school. You're surpassing so many other women and girls who haven't gone to school, right? And what did it feel like for you to see your colleagues kind of go and get married, your fellow female colleagues go and get married, and then meanwhile you're like, no, I'm gonna stick it out, I'm gonna keep going to school? What was that like?
Well, frankly, I didn't feel this when I went to the medical school, because I see a lot of my colleagues at school, at the intermediate school and high school, they get married, but that was normal in my community.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of them, they wanted to get married because this is what they heard always. This is what they know. This is what we always hear. So it was normal for me. And only few girls, and also for the boys, also, they don't study a lot in my community. You don't find a lot of educated people in my town, at least. So, for example, we have in my town, like 3 female doctors only.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't very, you know, the most of the girls get married early. So I didn't feel them that time when I started studying. But after I graduated, after the war, I felt like this because I heard, and we were in the hospital, for example, like only 12 nurses. We were 100 medical staff, but we have only 12 female ones. So yeah, that was here I start to think why the girls don't study. So support my mother's idea about education. It's really, yeah, education is everything. When you are educated, when you can do something, you know, you have the skill, you have the knowledge to do something. So it's easier for you. For example, many, many male volunteer in the hospital and start learning and work. It was very easy for them, but not many females volunteer. Only the females who study, who become nurses, for example, or doctors or medical technicians. So these female only were allowed to work. But when they try to volunteer and to learn, you find a lot of, you know, distractions, a lot of people gossip about you or say, no, you girl, you have to stay. But the boys don't hear this. They are allowed to start learning to volunteer. You know, there's many like differences. I started here to feel them and I said, okay, they were okay to get married early, but that's because their family don't tell them about the other life, the other option. They have only this option. They didn't hear that they can study, they can get education. And actually, my mom is educated, unlike many of the mothers in my town. So my mom was talking always about this, was always supporting me. And she doesn't allow me to do any of the housework. And she said always, like, you know, other girls in the houses. So they have to do, you know, the housework. So she said, no, go to study. It's more important.
That is exactly how my mom talked to me when I was younger. You don't need to learn how to cook right now. Just go study.
Exactly.
You start off the book with a really, really profound story about how you're in the cave and you notice tons and tons of people coming in from a chemical attack. And you talk about how you're the one pediatrician that people started coming to treat their kids. And throughout the book, you also mentioned that you didn't have too much practical training after coming out of medical school. And getting into a hospital setting like that with so much, almost with so much expectation, as well as so many people coming in to seek your help, how did you navigate that? How did you tell yourself, okay, I know I don't have so much practice and training, but I have to help these people?
I didn't expect to live in these circumstances, to see a war in my life, to live under siege and have no resources, not enough food or medicine, and to work in a hospital like this, an underground hospital. The chemical attack was the worst thing I witnessed in that time. Actually, the Syrian regime targeted the two cities in place by the sarin gas. And, you know, we didn't know what was it. We were only few doctors, some volunteers. So, and I explained all this in the book because I want to tell the people the whole truth about this, how horrific it was, how brutal the Syrian regime was with us. So, yeah, I found myself between many, many victims, some of them suffocating, some can't breathe, they need immediately help. So it was very hard. And I wasn't a pediatrician. I was just starting studying pediatrics. So it was very hard to deal with these cases. It was, you know, heartbreaking. Even now I'm talking about this and I can feel, I remember the faces of the children, their eyes, their fear. They were dying and many died in front of our eyes because we didn't help them. Sometimes, you know, I blame myself because I couldn't help all of them. It was, you know, impossible to help everyone in the emergency cases. So, yeah, that was horrific. I think no words can explain this massacre. I remember that people start to bring the children, the little babies, to put them around me to help them. And they said, this is the pediatrician. And I didn't have, you know, this experience. I don't, actually, no one have experience to deal with like mass casualties, suffocating with sarin gas. No one can do this. So what about our, you know, limited resources like and experience? So it was very, very hard. So I remember only now the bodies of the children, these bodies without the blood, without wounded, only with the dark lips and the eyes open. And yeah, I don't find anywhere to explain this. It's very hard to explain, but it's very, very brutal.
I can't even imagine. You know, in the book, you talk about how there was a point in time where there was bombings happening and it was just normal. It just felt like, oh, this is just another day. There was nothing new, in a sense. And for us, like living in the U.S., that we don't, this is not something that we experience, right? How is going from living with no violence or massacres to all of a sudden seeing massacres and violence and bombings all the time?
It's not normal in this meaning, but it's normal. Our days was very normal, like very, you know, a new day, as you say, bombing every day, hunger, people are starving. In the winter, it was very cold, no resources, no heating. In the summer, it was very hot and we don't have anything, you know, no electricity. Just every day, I get up in the morning, go to the hospital, live underground, in the dark places, we miss to see the sun. But, you know, nothing changed for year by year. The bombing started in 2012 in the Eastern Ghouta, started before in other places in Syria, maybe in 2011. So, yeah, like for 7 years, I was under bombing, under siege. We dreamed every day that the situation will change. something will happen. These massacres will stop, the bombing. The international community will do something to help us. We heard about the Security Council when they gathered to find the solution for us. But, you know, we waited for them. And yeah, year after year, nothing happened, nothing changed. So I said, yeah, it's normal to bomb. And honestly, to find like the warplane above you, to hear this very bad sound. And when it's bombed, it was really scary. But after that, like year after year, we hear the sound. We continue walking in the street if we can. I mean, it was really normal. I admit that we have this fear about our lives, but you know, it didn't change. So yeah, this is our life.
So I'm sure you know about what's happening, you know, in the world right now too, and you know, Gaza, Palestine. And do you have any thoughts? Or do you have any thoughts that you'd like to share around that? Because it seems like there's a lot of parallels that are happening.
Well, it's heartbreaking to see the same situation I lived, and especially the medical staff in the hospital and the doctors. I watch them in videos and see them like standing in front of their patients and could do nothing. They don't find, you know, the resources they want, the medical supplies. They cry just next to the victims, and they lost members of their families. So I felt the doctors there. I felt the medical staff, how they live. It's heartbreaking that this happened again in another place in the world. I wanted to tell my story, to try to tell all the people in the world that this shouldn't happen again. And we want to stop the war, stop bombing everywhere. But this happened again. So it breaks my heart, actually. And I honestly, I can't watch. I try just to know what happened and start watching videos. But when I see these children, and yeah, especially when the doctors make surgeries without anesthesia. And I remembered what, you know, that we also have the same situation. And it's very, you know, very hard. You can't feel this unless you live the same situation. Yeah. So I can feel them. I see the fear in that children's eyes under bombing when they flee and have nowhere to go. And I experienced the same situation.
So you ended up running this hospital underground. You became the director, elected director. And I can imagine how much pressure you must have felt to do a good job. What was it like stepping into this role? And I mean, like your dad said, you know, you were going to get a lot of headaches, and you mentioned that, but what was it like to be a director, especially as a woman in a place that didn't really value the contributions of a woman?
Exactly. They don't like to see women in a position, like a woman as a manager, as a director, anywhere, not only a hospital. And especially in the wartime and in my town, like where some also conservative military factions who controlled the area. So it was very hard. I thought that I'm a doctor like other doctors. They were managing the hospital and I can do the same. I believed in myself. I can do this. I know the hospital very well, and I know what we need, what we have to do. I have many ideas to improve the hospital. They elected me, also my colleagues, and they believe that I can do this. But I started, you know, to hear this from people around us. Many people have this sauce against women, and they said, no, you are women, you shouldn't be here. And you can imagine, between all the pressure, the bombing, the siege, the working, you know, in this underground, it was very hard. Also, because I'm a woman, I have, you know, this additional pressure. So it was very hard to hear this. But I wanted to do something for women, for all the women in my community. I thought, if I fail in this position, so they will talk about she failed and she couldn't do anything. So I had to succeed and to do something within this hospital. So I tried to do my best to help. I tried to hire other women in the hospital, make training for them. I did my best, and it was the central hospital in the area, and I can say the biggest maybe. So we could, as a team, we could do a lot to help people. And we succeed in many places. So I'm actually happy that I met this hospital. The last campaign in 2000 against the place, the Syrian regime bombed many of the hospitals and destroyed it, but my hospital stayed. We could make, we made tunnels underground, they protected. So many men came to me that time and they said that you did a great job. You succeed. And these same men who were criticizing me, and they said before that, no, you are a woman, you shouldn't be here. You have to stay at your clinic just as a pediatrician, not as a manager. So I was very happy to hear this. I could change their minds, not only for me, for all the women in my community.
That must have felt really good for you, just to hear that. Exactly. Yeah. So during this time, I wanted to know if there was a story where you turned from doctor to an activist. You know, I know that you said that there were three that came in, spent a bunch of years with you to, you know, document what it was like to run this hospital. And then you started getting interviewed and all of that. But was there a time where you thought, oh, I'm not just a doctor, but I'm actually an activist. I'm advocating for all of these people here.
Well, look, I didn't think about this a lot. I just working as a doctor in the hospital, then managing the hospital. And then I just found that all the people around the world have responsibility to help us. I mean, as a human beings, you know, everyone have to help everyone. This is what I believe in. So I thought they don't know what happened. So I have to tell them, and everyone has to tell them. And you can see a lot of people in the Eastern Ghouta and the place carries cameras and do interviews, film and make videos to show the world what happens here. So and also, you know, the propaganda with the Syrian regime, Russia and Iran, they have, you know, they are stronger than us. So they tell their stories. So I said, no, it's our responsibility to tell the truth. That was my goal. So I started, you know, to make interviews when some people asked me, could you talk in the camera? Could you tell what you're doing now, for example, in the emergency room or with the kids or, you know, with the patients? I said, yeah, sure, you can film, show the people what happened so we will get help. That was our goal. And after we left the place, we forced to leave, actually. After that, I found myself have also the same responsibility to tell the story of the victims, the people who died, the children who died, and they have the right to live a better life. And the people who are still suffering now, for example, in the camps, millions of people now, of Syrian people living in camps inside Syria and in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, around Syria. So I feel like I now have a voice, so I have to talk about these people. Maybe I have more access, you know, to the media. So I have now to talk about them. It's my responsibility. So I started, you know, to talk, to advocate for them, try to get help in any way. Like, these people are suffering. They need everything. Like, millions of children now can't go to school. They get no education. They need food. They need heat in the winter. They need everything. They have no hope living for years in the tent under rain, under snow. You can imagine the life there and their suffering. So it just was a responsibility, not like I want to be an activist. Yeah, not this way. I will help if like as a doctor if needed anytime, of course. But I think now it's more important to do this for these people.
Mm-hmm. You just kind of automatically became that person that spoke out. I want to ask you, like, what prompted you to write the book?
Well, I said, I feel like I know the stories of these people, and I wanted to write the book especially to tell the story about this period, the war time, the siege time. I told my story from the beginning, childhood, to let people know how was it, the life, how we changed, and as a refugee also to know the suffering of the Syrian refugee. But this period especially, and the stories of the victims, was the main reason that I want to tell this story. I said, maybe many of stories, many of children who died, for example, I'm the only person who know their stories. And I felt like they have the right to be known. And I wrote their names in the book to tell the people that there were an innocent child here. And they dream, they have their dreams, they have their hopes, they wanted to be something, they wanted to study, to be like you or everyone. Just like listen to their story and know about them. And you maybe, and everyone who could help and didn't, I want to tell them that you had this responsibility to help these kids, but you didn't. But you still, you know, still can help the others, still can save their lives. So I wanted to tell these stories, to tell the whole truth. By the documentary, to me, it was very short, and you can see many like of the stories, the scenes, the faces of the children, because, you know, it was short. And actually, the people who made the film with me, they wanted people, other people to be able to see, to watch this without seeing, you know, the blood, the fear. So, you know, it's hard to see this. So I wanted to tell more, a lot of, you know, the whole truth, as I call it. So that's why I felt like the book, maybe you can't see, but you can read and feel this. So I wanted the people around the world to know more, to know what happened in Syria and to help if they can.
I also think that books, when written like the way that you wrote your book, it gives you even more of a visual than a film can. You know, I know you said that they cut out a lot of the very bloody scenes, but you were able to write about it. And it gives people that perspective of, or even just tries to help them visualize what you had to go through and what other people were going through during this time. And so I think one of my last questions to you is really, I think a lot of people, especially people who live in high-income countries, high-middle-class people, they see this on the TV or on social media. Like right now, we're seeing a lot of just horrific things happening, and they feel as if they can't do anything about it. Like they're helpless about it. And like, what advice would you give these people who feel like, what can I do? You know?
Yeah, it looks, when you see very big, like big war or big crisis somewhere, and you look at it, you see, look, I can do nothing for this. I can't help. But this is untrue, because if everyone do their part, so as you know, a lot of people can, of course, they can make change. I believe that everyone can help everyone, and everywhere in the US and Europe, they can help. They can help not only in Syria, in all the places who you find people are suffering, everywhere in Palestine. You can help. You can do, just do your part, and everyone can do their part. You can speak up for them. You can speak to the politicians. You can make pressure. So they make, you know, pressure on the both sides, for example, for the war. They can just speak up, talk about these people, tell others about them. You can donate also for the organizations. For example, in Syria, there are a lot of organizations who supported these people. And one of them, the organization that I joined after I left, it's a medical organization, Syrian American Medical Society. We supported many hospitals and medical facilities there. We, you know, we do a lot to help people there. So you can donate for these organizations who support the, for example, they support education, they find people jobs, they support, you know, food, or make, also they make the street, for example, the civil defense, for example, in Syria. So you can donate, you can support these people. If you don't want to donate, for example, talk about them, advocate for them. Yeah. So you see that you can do something. Just you need to, I think our responsibility is to look for these places, just, you know, research and find these places, feel these people who are suffering, and, you know, try what you can to help them.
Yeah. And I mean, at the very least, build awareness around it, you know, tell people about what's happening. So I want to ask you now, like, you're living in New Jersey. How has life been transitioning from your life in Syria to your life in the United States? How are you doing?
Well, you know, it's very different here. But many times I feel like I still live between the Syria because, you know, there is no social life in the U.S. and not a lot of people and friends around me. So I'm always like on social media talking mm-hmm. with my friends in Syria, watching their news. So I feel like I'm living between them. So I know a lot about them, if you ask me, but I don't know a lot about, for example, a shop next to my house. Mm-hmm. I know nothing. But, you know, it's very different here. At least it's safe. And I wish everywhere stay safe. But yeah, when I feel like I feel warm, I see my kids are safe around me. I feel like I have food for today and tomorrow. I feel this only when meal to eat and they don't know what to do for next meal. I mean, this good life here, it's very good comparing with the life in Syria. So this good life should remind us with other people. When you feel warm, just remember there's people who have nothing to be warm under, you know, in a tent, under snow. So yeah, I feel it's very different. And sometimes I blame myself because I'm safe here. And I'm warm here and I'm not hungry. I say if I was hungry and unsafe with them, maybe I would feel like more satisfied than now. I'm trying to, you know, do everything I can, do my best to help the people who stayed there.
Talk a little bit more about that feeling that you mentioned, feeling like you're guilty, like you felt guilty for being in a part of the world that isn't in danger.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard to see all the people that you know, or most of them, your friends, your colleagues, part of my family, to see them unsafe. They feel like they live in, some of them live under the control of the Syrian regime now. They are afraid. They have nothing, you know, high prices there. They suffer to get food, for example. And to see other people in the under bombing or in the earthquake place. So you see all of them are suffering. All of them are afraid. They want in safe place, warm place. They want to get education for kids. They all suffer. And I feel myself, I'm safe here. My kids are around me. And yeah, I feel really guilty because I don't suffer with them. I'm trying to treat myself just try to help them, do something good for them. It's much, you know, better than blaming myself and just say, oh, I'm guilty. No, go try to help, do something. Don't just sit and feel sad for the people. Also, when we watch, for example, now, watch other crises in the world, we watch it, what's happened, for example, in Gaza. We feel like very sad. We cry for them and then turn off the TV and go to continue your life. No, just go do something. Try to do something. If you can do nothing, just talk about them. Tell other people that we have, like as a human beings, we are responsible about each other. We have to care about each other. I mean, if something happened to us, anything happened and everyone stays safe. But if something happened, you will find no one cares about you. It's very hard feeling, you know. I feel this and I don't want anyone to feel the same feeling. So care about others, just do something for them. And I'm sure everyone who listening now can do something.
I agree. Well, I think that for anybody who's listening to this episode, once Dr. Amani's book comes out, go and purchase her book. It's called The Cave. It sheds so much light around the Syrian regime, about how life was like, about her stories, you know, managing this hospital. And I want you to just go and read it because it's so eye-opening. And, you know, I've heard people say, I just read a book and now I have a nonprofit that helps these people. So one book, even just reading one book, can make a difference. So all of the link to get this book will be in the description. Any other related links will be in there too. make sure to check it out. Make sure to learn about Dr. Imani Balur. And I'm just so thankful for having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for giving me the honor of interviewing you. I'm very thankful.
Thank you so much. The honor is all mine. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you'd like to learn more about today's topic and guest, head over to the show notes linked in the description of this episode. There, you can get access to resources, links, and ways you can get involved in the pursuit for global health. And if you loved this episode, don't forget to write me a review on Apple Podcasts and rate the podcast on Spotify. It helps me get in front of more people just like you and continues to elevate the causes we are so passionate about. I'll see you in the next one.